Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to Off the Charts, the podcast that brings you in-depth analysis and insights on the OTC listed company each week. I'm your host, Phil Carroll, and joining me are my co-host, Kevin Hornsby, and our resident analyst and investor, Charles Archer. Together, we'll explore the exciting world of emerging companies and the opportunities they present. Welcome back again, gents. Episode 3, and we have a very special guest for you from the world of investing. How is everyone?
Fantastic. How are you, Phil?
Well, good, yeah. It's been a long summer. I've had a bit of downtime, and I know you haven't, Charles. We joked about this in the past, but yeah, it's been really good. The weather's been good. Make the most of it. And I know Kev's been sunning himself on the beach as usual. So actually, we should be asking you what's been happening in the markets and in the news, Charles, because I've not even picked up a newspaper.
Well, I'll tell you what.
I think Charles is actually an American, I think. That's why he only has 10 days holiday a year, I think.
10 days? Outrageous amount of holiday. Who needs that?
He's a massive amount for his health care, you know, cripples himself each month on his...
Yeah, well, dude, I have a private dentist. That is a limit of my expenditure. But no, because you can't get an NHS one anymore. But no, I was saying to a client the other day, right, there's a gentleman's agreement in the UK, which you probably don't have in the US, which is you don't release material news in August. Everybody has a nice, relaxing month off, a break. You know, you're meant to release things immediately, but for some reason, everyone just goes on holiday. This didn't happen this year. Everyone seems to have masses of information they must immediately release to an audience of investors who are just at the beach and not paying attention. So, but such is life. It's been good. I mean, obviously, on America, on the state side kind of things, it's Kamala Harris is you know, all the rage, apparently. I feel sorry for the Americans because, you know, our election, we had Keir Starmer versus Rishi Sunak, which is, you know, not a particularly pleasant choice. But now they've got the choice between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. And I couldn't tell you who I'd vote for because they're both just so awful. I mean, Kamala, her first campaign interview, you know, just went out. It lasted 27 minutes. She had to get babysitted by Tim Walz. And just when she talks, right, like she could have come on this podcast with us because she would not be able to formulate a thought without being told what to think. It's terrifying. But then you have Donald, on the other hand, who can't think at all. So, you know, I think whoever you vote for America, you're not going to have a fun time just like us. Enjoy.
I disagree with you in terms of Donald. I think Donald thinks, but it doesn't go through his brain before it comes out of his mouth. But the interesting thing, did you see the clip about Kamala Harris and cloud computing?
Oh my God!
This cracks me up every time I see it.
Right out there is Liz Truss and the, you know, the cheese.
She's picturing the clouds above her head.
Yeah. It's scary, right? It's scary because okay, right. This is the thing. We've all got children, right? I feel like we've all got children. Yeah.
Yeah.
And my 10-year-old knows way more about how to operate a computer than I do, and I'm only in my mid-30s. And this every generation, it's the same. The younger children, as they grow up with technology, they know more, okay? But then you have this older generation who literally know nothing unless they've decided actively to educate themselves. And she wants to lead the free world, but she doesn't know what a cloud is. That's just terrifying. And the other thing is, you know...
Does that mean if it rains that the information comes down to the earth?
Oh, I feel so. Every time there's a precipitation event, your data is leaked. But the other thing is, I used to work in a free university, worked in like bars, right, and serving drinks to all manner of people in nightclubs. Very common thing to do. And the thing I get with Kamala, you know, maybe I shouldn't say this publicly on a podcast, but I just think alcoholic. That's the other thing. I mean, you look at her, the speeches, the slurring, the way she talks. She's not competent. But then neither is Donald. So, you know, pick one.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. And she has a great laugh, doesn't she? You could imagine going for a drink with her.
She'd be hilarious, good fun. I think we'd be best mates. I wouldn't want her running my bank account.
Trump's already said that he's going to expose Kamala for the fraud she is and claims she is a weaponizing Marxist. So harsh words from Trump there.
Yeah. I don't know that she's that smart to be a Marxist, to be honest. No, but anyway, sorry, Americans here. We're just seeing it from afar. But
be aware, we had an equally disappointing election with Arno, and now we have a new prime minister who's potentially just as loathed as our last one. So we're all in the same boat.
Yes, indeed.
And you just alluded to bar owners and being seen in a bar. Our guest actually started off as a bar owner in Canada. So I'm going to give you a massive introduction. And as Kev says, no pressure at all for the guest. But here's our new first guest this week. We're thrilled to introduce Rick Rule, a renowned investor, financial commentator, and founder and CEO of Rule Investment Media. Widely recognized for his expertise in mining, energy, water utilities, forest products, and agriculture sectors. Rick's career has been marked by his unique approach to merchant banking in the resource sector, where he focuses on providing capital, strategic direction, and transaction management for undervalued companies. Rick is not only known for his deep understanding of market cycles, but also for his distinctive investment model that involves direct investment in natural resource projects, often providing both capital and expertise to help companies move from exploration to production stages. His method emphasizes close collaboration with company management to ensure successful project execution and risk management. Apart from his professional pursuits, Rick is a respected speaker at industry conferences, namely his symposium, where he shares his insights on resource investing, economic trends, and personal finance. His commentary is valued for its depth and practicality, offering investors at all levels strategies to enhance their understanding and performance in the resource segment. As the founder of Global Resource Investments and Sprott Asset Management, Rick has built a reputation for his prudent investment strategies and has become a trusted figure for investors seeking guidance on navigating the complexities of the resource market. His perspectives are informed by decades of hands-on experience and a profound understanding of both the technical and financial aspects of resource investment. Let's delve into Rick's philosophy and explore how he shaped the landscape of resource investing. Welcome to the podcast, Rick.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. Thank you for having me on your show as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So just talk
to us. I hope you can live up to that, Rick, because that was quite an introduction.
Game of Thrones lady, all this one.
No pressure, Rick.
Of the great cast. See, yeah.
I couldn't even have written that introduction, so thank you.
No problem. So, I mean, just talk us through your background. I mean, obviously, you know, that you're a big name in the investing space. Talk us through the path from what I can gather from doing a bit of research, from the Vancouver bar owner to international speculator and investor. You know, what first got you into finance in the investing space?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. As a young man, I was very interested in biology and very interested in geology. The consequence of that is that I left the United States, emigrated to Canada. There were extenuating factors, of course, Vietnam. And I went to the University of British Columbia and had to have a job at night. The only transferable skill I had was that I was large. And I boxed for 10 years, so I became a bouncer. One thing led to another. I went from being a bouncer to a bar owner. And my bar was the epicenter to the sort of nascent Vancouver Stock Exchange. This happened while I was simultaneously in university. And I found that I was learning more about the type of finance and investing that I was interested in the bar, getting the Vancouver Stock Exchange players, frankly, very drunk and asking them questions when I was sober and they weren't. I was learning more doing that than I was listening to my professors who had no money drone on about subjects that they only knew intellectually. As soon as my success in the hospitality industry allowed me to build enough capital that I could leave it and employ it in natural resources, I did so. The hospitality business was a transition for me. It was a way to get through school and a way to get started in business. So I've been principally employed in natural resource finance, and then later in my career, also in conventional financial services, insurance businesses, banking businesses. I've been continuously employed in this business now for 50 of my 71 years on Earth. Initially, my interest was in oil and gas. I am still extremely interested in oil and gas, but I found, frankly, that in the oil and gas business, I had a lot of intellectual competition. There were a lot of really, really, really good people, hardworking people in oil and gas finance. And I found in the early stages of mining finance that the challenge wasn't getting over the bar, it was getting under the bar. That the level of competition that I faced in that business was so low that although the oil business is a better business than the mining business, I could do better concentrating on mining. As my career advanced and I became successful and built capital, one of the things I chose to do to get my capital out of immediate harm's way was to invest in farmland and timberland, and hence that interest. I guess an unflattering thing is that I sort of jumped, luckily, from one mistake to the next and managed over time to have a wonderful life doing business with spectacular people on behalf of spectacular customers. And I learned to take advantage of volatility, and I learned to take advantage of the cyclicality in resource businesses. When they are out of favor, you have to really, really, really storm in. And when they return to favor, when they become popular, you have to fairly aggressively ease out. Most people employ the exact opposite strategy.
Really do.
You know, they sell in disgust at market bottoms, yeah, and they buy with alacrity at market tops, and that ends up not working out well for them.
Yeah, I think you've alluded to it in the past. Is it that you call it the contrarian investing model? And you actually, I think I've heard you mention that you invest in some ways in stocks that have been negatively talked about. Just talk us through some of those investments or what sectors you potentially invest in. And I know we've heard Buffett say that if he doesn't understand the stock, then he simply will not invest in it, which sounds pretty reasonable. But people, you know, maybe look at the balance sheets. But in junior exploration space or project incubators, there generally isn't a balance sheet because they're just burning through cash. So what do you look for? What are some of the green flags and red flags in your investment strategy?
Let's segregate first between investing, which doesn't include junior miners, and speculating, which does. I do both. I suggest that speculation is the application of capital against the possibility, not probability, the possibility of very, very, very large returns. Investing is different. It's the application of capital with the probability of reasonable returns relative to the risks. And I do both, and I employ different strategies. My investing strategies are almost completely contrarian. The bargains for the application with the expectation of above average returns only happens in commodities when they're out of favor. Let me give you a wonderful example. In, I guess it was the year 2020, COVID hit. And so demand for oil as a transportation fuel fell like a boulder off a bridge. The oil quote fell, if my memory serves me correctly, from $80 a barrel to briefly sub-zero before settling out at about $20 a barrel. I knew from statistics from the International Energy Agency that the fully loaded cost of producing oil worldwide, including tax and cost of capital, was $60 a barrel. So it was very obvious to me that either the oil price would go up to $60 a barrel or nobody's car would start. Those were the two alternatives. And I had to think which was more likely. At the same time, the finest oil company on the planet, Exxon, best capital allocator in the world in the oil business, got thrown out of the Dow Jones 30. So all of the index buyers that owned it had to sell it. This is a non-repeatable sell signal. It just doesn't get better than that. The dominant player in a business where the price has to triple, that has a one-off event that causes 15% of the float to get sold.
It's crazy stuff, isn't it?
So basically what you're saying is you went long at about minus $3.
I wish. The truth is that I waited 3 weeks too long. I thought, you know, it can still get cheaper. And then I actually read a Buffett quote where he said, sometimes things are cheap enough. And that inured to my benefit. The other wonderful thing, actually, it wasn't Buffett that said this, but my former mentor and partner, Eric Sprott, said, don't be afraid to be right. If all of the factors associated with an investment are on your side, or if the upside is very quantifiable relative to the downside, don't limit your risk. You know, really, really, really go in. And I'm delighted to say with Exxon, after my 3 weeks of procrastination and stupidity, I put a lot of chips on the table. And if you'll see the Exxon chart in the period 2020 to today, you know, you'll see that that worked out well for me. Speculation is very different. Speculation, to me, is about answering a series of unanswered questions, primarily in exploration. Speculation, too, is about overemphasizing people relative to narrative. There's a dictum that you're probably familiar with called Pareto's Law. That's the social science description of what's popularly referred to as the 80-20 syndrome, where 20% of the population does 80% of the work. In speculation, it's important to know the entirety of Pareto's law. It's a bell-shaped curve, so one 20% of the population generates 80% of the utility, a different 20% generates 80% of the aggravation. So your first task is to hang out with the good 20 and avoid the bad 20, you know, with a barge pole. But it becomes more interesting as a speculator when you understand that in large tasks with large population bases, both the good lip and the bad lip, if run through the same performance dispersal curve, conformably align, which means that 80% of the 80% is achieved by 20% of the 20%, or 4% of the population generates 65% of the utility. And you learn in junior mining that you can run that same performance dispersal curve by at least one more standard deviation, which means that 0.8% of the promoters generate 40% of the utility. The most important part of my speculative career was learning by age 35 to hang out with the 1%. Now, because of boredom or greed, I've often gotten away from the 1%, which is really profoundly stupid. The rewards that I've enjoyed relative to the pain I've suffered, stepping out of my 1% ghetto, has meant that every time I've done it, on balance, it's been stupid. The second thing that I think speculators need to understand is speculation is taking risk with the probability of failure, but the possibility of outsized success. If you don't have the psychological strength and the financial strength to weather a series of 25 or 30% losses, you don't belong as a speculator, because the arithmetic is that your 1,000% gains have to amortize your 20 or 25% losses. And if you don't have the financial wherewithal and the psychological wherewithal to stand many more losses than wins, you shouldn't be a speculator. And further, any individual speculation that you get into has to have a large enough reward that you can't take the risk inherent in speculation for marginal wins, even though they're psychologically gratifying. The people who I see who are traders who are trying to buy a 25-cent stock in hopes of selling it for 35 cents, to me, are analogous to people bending over to pick up nickels in front of steamrollers. If the probability is failure, the reward for success needs to compensate you for the probability of failure. I hope that long-winded narrative helps, because you asked a question that I think is extremely useful to audiences who haven't had to have been as focused on the outcomes as I have.
You're preaching to the choir here, I think, definitely to me. Literally, from the very start, with sort of university professors only have the academic credentials but no money in the bank to back them up, all the way up to the reward has to be worth the risk. You know, I mean, I see so many companies where you know, the exploration risk means that, you know, ultimately you're quite likely to fail. You know, you may be a 20% chance of success if you're lucky. And Therefore, you've got to have a 5x reward at the end of that, at least. And if You don't, there's hundreds of other companies to choose from. I mean,
or the other thing, you know, Warren Buffett described investing as a game of baseball with no called strikes.
Yeah.
There's no harm in doing nothing.
Yeah.
You just wait for the pitcher to throw up a real fat, slow pitch.
Yeah. 100% true. I think, you know, I probably have more cash in my portfolio than I have done in the past couple of years. Because my perspective is that we're due a big crash. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. But sort of, sometimes I look at, you know, it's like an opportunity will come across and I'll look at it and go, this actually isn't that good. I'd much rather just have the cash and the 5% return until something better comes along.
That's great discipline.
And okay, here's a question. I mean, when you step out of your kind of, like, you're saying the top 1%, if you step out, you tend to get punished for it. Is there ever been a company where you've invested, maybe broken your own rules, but it's returned for you? It's done well for you anyway.
Often. My favorite example, the most dramatic example, was in 1998. I was absolutely convinced that uranium was going to go crazy.
Right.
The stuff was selling for $8 a pound. It cost the industry $30 a pound to make it. We'd been in a 20-year bear market. It wasn't just that investors were bored of uranium. When I talk about uranium from a dais in a conference facility, people were hostile. They'd say, you're attempting to make money on human misery. Chernobyl, Nagasaki, Three Mile Island. But boredom is attractive to me, but there's nothing I like as much as hate.
Yeah.
So I was on the uranium thesis like white on rice, and I was in Kalgoorlie, Australia, the middle of nowhere, at a wild investment conference called Diggers and Dealers. A great, really a great big intellectual drunk. I met a guy named John Borshoff, who I'd never heard of, and he had a $1.8 million Australian market cap company, non-viable, in the uranium space, and I just couldn't help myself. You know, nobody ever heard of this guy, but I visited with him, and I said, so just out of curiosity, Mr. Borshoff, you got a $1.8 million market cap. How are you going to afford the money to explore? He looks at me, and he says, I don't have to. And I think, oh, God, you know, spare me. But I decided to play along. I said, okay, so tell me, just out of curiosity, how you can have an exploration company who doesn't have to explore. I said, well, I was the exploration manager for a peristatal controlled by the West German government, and I spent $1 billion looking for uranium for them. When they shut down the project and they were giving me my severance, I got them to give me their database. So I have $1 billion worth of West German exploration expenditure in my basement.
Wow.
I don't have to explore for anything. I just have to stake all the shit I already discovered. That was the best single answer I ever heard in my life, you know?
Yeah, I do.
So we did a $2 million private placement and a $1.8 million company. You know, I mean, really, save the company check. Wonderful. I remember we did the deal at a dime. This is a wonderful story. We did the deal at a dime way too early, you know, way, way, way too early.
Right.
Uranium didn't move for 4 years. And I was rewarded for my genius by seeing the stock go from 10 cents to 9 cents to 8 cents to 7 cents to 6 cents to 5 cents to 4. You know, you get the point.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
At about a penny, I said, okay, I got to revisit my premise, right? I'm off 90% for my genius.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a hold here. I have a buy or a sell. And so I revisited the whole premise, got Borshoff on the phone for 5 hours or something like that. I said, okay, I'm right. The market's wrong.
Yeah.
Sadly, I didn't get any a penny, just like Exxon. I procrastinated, but I got some at, one and a half or 1.6. 6 years later, that stock was at 10 bucks.
Wow.
So that's the best story.
There are
many stories, however, where I varied from my rules for whatever reason and got smashed.
Yeah.
So, Rick, your own personal wealth, has it been made on the markets, or have you created businesses yourself that has allowed
both? I mean, I've made much more money as an investor and speculator than I have as a business builder. But I've been part of building a couple good businesses. Sprott Inc., which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, bought one of my financial services businesses. And the consequence of that is that I'm the largest shareholder in Sprott Inc. I'm not an officer. I'm not a director. I'm not an employer. A New York Stock Exchange traded bank called EverBank, one of the first of the online brokers in the United States, was started on my living room floor. We built that business, took it public on the New York Stock Exchange, ultimately sold it to TIAA Cref. I've been part now of forming 5 community banks, which were businesses that, you know, I helped build. Well, that's not true. I backed managers, provided perhaps adult supervision, and I was part of building and selling an insurance company. So I have been a reasonable, successful company builder, but my heart is in investing and speculating.
When
and
you say insurance companies, were you talking about life insurance companies or general insurance companies?
Property and casualty businesses. My own insurance business now is involved in catastrophe and super catastrophe risk in the offshore oil and gas business. And my other insurance business is in environmental remediation and bonding in the oil and gas and mining businesses. I'm only interested in financial services businesses that are specific to things I understand.
And those businesses are not a crowded space either, I wouldn't imagine.
Yeah. Like most other businessmen, I'm a proven failure at businesses I don't understand. I'm a big believer in durable competitive advantages. I've made some truly catastrophic mistakes in businesses I understand. Imagine the difficulty that I would run into in businesses that I didn't understand.
So, if you had to live life again in terms of your financial decisions, not necessarily business, but let's talk about speculation, would you miss the ride and avoid all the speculation? Or would you rather have even more speculation because it's a lot of fun?
I wish my wife were here. she would tell you that, you know, I make fun of speculators all the time. And then she'll grab the conversation and say, you understand that all of the money now that Rick invests sagely, he made by speculating wildly.
Yeah.
I mean, what I would have done is that I would have cast my financial life in an insurance wrapper much earlier. Insurance is, I think, the best business in the world as a business. if you are disciplined. The second thing is that around the world, governments want insurance companies to be hypersolvent. The consequences of that is that you can over-reserve. And if you over-reserve, you pay less tax. The reason that Buffett pays tax at an effective rate of 9 or 10% is that he can set his policy loss reserves at any number that's feasible. They're consistently 6 or 7 times his policy loss experience. So that $200 billion in float that he talks about is really a deferred tax liability. And the idea that you can live your portfolio life as a prior taxpayer is something I didn't learn about till I was about 50. I wish I would have learned that lesson when I was 25. I had a partner, I have a partner still, that doesn't invest and uses the money that he extorts from me to make me less efficient in business. And I wish that I had understood the tax efficiency of insurance company investing when I was in my 20s.
But does that answer the question? Would you have taken more gamble or less?
Depends on the time. I'm under allocated as a speculator right now. I'm actively trying to take more risk. As you get older and the amount of money that you deploy increases, the availability and the scale that is offered up to you in speculation becomes less relative to your net worth. If I'm considering an investment because a bank has to divest a piece of the senior revolving credit facility at Exxon, I can allocate $10 million to that, and the decision takes 10 seconds. By contrast, deciding to invest $500,000 in an exploration project in Ethiopia or the Congo or Bolivia, where I really have to understand it, requires a lot of time, and I can't allocate much capital. So when you get old and fat and bald and rich like me, not only for reasons of risk avoidance, but really for reasons of capacity, both financial capacity and intellectual capacity, you gravitate more towards investing. You can't help it.
How many speculation deals do you have, do you think, in the market as we speak?
You mean how many speculative positions?
Yeah, I'm not talking about how much, just how many.
I think I have 52 names that I either own in size or by way of library cards.
Okay, and of those 52, how many do you think are going to deliver for you in percentage terms? And how many not?
100, of course, but...
realistic, are we all 100%?
That isn't the way it works out.
No. If it was, genius. But, you know, I have found over the past few years that the ones that I think are going to do extraordinarily well only do quite well. And the ones where I think, they'll do quite well are actually the ones that deliver 5-10 times return in a year, and you don't expect it at all. Do you find that at all or not?
It has really been variable. I mean, really, truly, it's been variable. I have had streaks as measured by the partnerships that I used to run. I mean, my best streak was in the year 2000. And if memory serves me correctly, that partnership generated a 79% compound internal rate of return per annum after fees. Wow. Truly, stupidly successful. You know, if you generate what's functionally an 80% compound internal rate of return for 8 years...
Yeah.
What happens at the end is insane. I had a different partnership. This would have been the 2005 partnership, where I lost 60% of my money.
Yeah.
So, and I, well, my strategy probably did vary. I was probably more aggressive in 2005 because of the insane success I enjoyed in 1998 and 2000. I was probably more aggressive, more inclined to confuse a bull market with brains, more aggressive about putting money out because I lulled myself into the expectation of return.
Do you think at this moment in time, here we are, 2024, the world's has gone crazy in the last number of years in terms of the requirement to change to a greenification scenario?
Yep.
And all of a sudden, we need more metal out of the ground than we've ever physically needed in history. And yet we see junior explorers on the floor in terms of their valuations, and nobody willing to back them, nobody willing to put money up.
I would disagree with that statement. Private placements, the financings that I've tried to get into in the last 2 years are invariably oversubscribed. It's a very small subset of the juniors, but the private placements that I've tried to get into with high-quality people and high-quality deposits, there has been a lot of competition. We believe, we've done some work on this, like not just me, but a young intern, that's finance speak for slave, has sort of back-tested the opportunities that we've been exposed to for the last 2 years. And the average private placement that we've tried to get into has been 50 or 60% oversubscribed. So when people say that there isn't money available to the juniors, I think that's a misstatement. I also would call your attention to the fact that most juniors aren't worth financing. If you look at the 3,000 or so public companies that purport to be junior mining companies on exchanges around the world, I don't know what the actual number is, I would suggest that only 15% are viable. If you merged every junior in the world into one company, we'll call it Junior Explorco, that company in a good year would lose $2 billion. Expenses over realized sales and M&A, stuff like that. In a bad year, which perversely they would think is a good year, a year where they could raise a lot of money, they'd lose $8 billion. So tell me what you would pay for a company that loses $2 billion a year. Would you pay 5 times losses? 9 times losses? In a good market, would you pay 15 times losses? The point is that if you, quote, invest in the sector indiscriminately, you will lose all your money.
Yeah. 100%.
That disguises the fact that maybe 5% of the issuers, and this, of course, goes back to Pareto's law, 5% of the issuers generate so much value that they add legitimacy and sometimes even luster to a sector that loses $2 billion a year. The sector would be in much better shape if 75% of the issues went broke and the capital that was left over was focused on the remnant.
Good. Okay, so Rick, obviously, you seem to give time to investors and also happy to guest on podcasts like The Roast. Obviously, thanks for that. And I know you urge people to go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com, list their resource stocks, and for no charge, you will rank them from like 1 to 10, 1 being the best, 10 being the worst. So we've kind of got a small job for you today. We're going to pitch a couple of companies each to you, and we want to kind of hear your thoughts and maybe pick, not necessarily a winner, but maybe rank them from one to six. Or order.
How about one to ten? How about one to ten, where I'm familiar?
Yeah. Okay, let's do that then. So obviously, no doubt you will probably know one or two of these companies, and maybe you've already got some ownership in your portfolio, but let's start with one from me. So the first one is Sovereign Metals, arguably one of the best growth stocks in the junior resource space. Yep. They're listed on multiple markets, on ASX under SVM, AIM in the UK as SVML, and on the OTCQX as SVMLF. They're currently a market cap of around 175 million UK. The company controls the Kasia deposit in Malawi, which is the largest rutile and second largest natural flake graphite deposit in the world. The company has a PFS with key takeaways, mineral resource estimate of Kasia, estimate about 1.8 billion tonnes at 1% rutile, which results in 17.9 million tonnes of contained natural rutile and 24.4 million tonnes of contained graphite, 1.605 billion after-tax NPV on the project, and a 28% IRR. They've been busy boosting the team. They enjoy expertise and technical support of Mining Titan, a major investor of Rio Tinto, who have a large investment in the company with 19.76% after recently increasing their position. And the company also gave a brief update on the south. Excitingly, all newly defined mineralization remains open at depth due to limitations of the hand auger drilling. The PSF was itself limited both in terms of deposit already known and in terms of what is clearly more graphite and rutile to be found. There's also a pilot plan. Obviously, that big news came in during late May when Sovereign announced plans to immediately start a pilot mining program at Kasia as part of its wider ongoing optimization study. And Sovereign is excavating some 150,000 bench cubic meters of ore from a test pit over a 3-month period using a combination of dry and hydraulic mining. Many think it's only a matter of time before Rio tables an offer for the company and take the whole shooting match. For that remains to be seen, but things are certainly looking good at Sovereign. So over to you, Kev.
So the first one I'm going to cover is Conroy Gold in Ireland. They basically discovered a gold district related to the Clay Lake Nugget, which is currently in the Ulster Museum. It has a JORC report of 512 ounces on its Clontibret wholly owned property, with potential to extend that out, as only 20% of that area has actually been put inside the JORC report. It's also discovered a second trend with visible gold at surface of 123 grams per ton. It has a market cap of circa 3 million. And one of the reasons why I chose it, because this really is one of the things myself and Charles have been talking about, those stocks that could do 100 times, not 10 times, but they could also fail as well, as we know. It has 100% of the licenses. It had a JV with a Damor Export, a company, a Turkish company, that had no real experience in gold. They spent 6 million euros on the project, advanced it a lot more, especially in the Clay Lake project, which looks like it could be a huge 1.5 kilometers by 2 kilometers section of stockwork of gold. And they've done previous geologists, the surveys were the trend they anticipate could have 20 million plus ounces of gold. So it's likely as a near-term catalyst that the if Klopp von Schubert can actually be pushed forward, that probably is somewhere in the region of 2 to 3 million ounces of gold in that particular scenario. It's tightly held stock with a few large shareholders.
Sure. I think I'll go for Power Metal Resources first, because this is one that I've been covering for a couple of years, and for some reason, it doesn't seem to want to rise. Eventually it will. I'm confident of it. One day it'll just rocket. But when I look at Power Metal, it's a merchant banking model. They've got so many assets all over the world. The ones to focus on at the moment, there's a Athabasca Uranium joint venture with ACAM. That's worth up to £15.2 million to the company. £10 million of exploration plus cash. Power staked massive, massive amount, 100,000 acres of real estate in the Athabasca Basin before the uranium bull run. And now they're on the verge of signing this really great joint venture deal. They're also on the verge of launching either Power Arabia or some kind of joint venture in Saudi Arabia, where a few months ago, back in January, Power was one of the few companies that managed to sign a memorandum of understanding with the Ministry of Investment of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So they're bringing that expertise, that exploration expertise, into a country that kind of desperately wants it. And then on top of that, they hold almost 50% of the shares in Guardian Metal Resources, rebranded from Golden Metal, which has the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit on US soil. And we recently saw China banning or very heavily restricting the export of antimony. And I reckon that tungsten is about to get banned as well. When that happens, grant funding from the US government for Guardian Metal is going to happen. That's going to impact on the Pantel share price. So which of the three, Rick, would you say is the best at the moment? I reckon I could guess.
Let's take them from the top. I have Sovereign as a four. Ironically, I love the validation that Rio Tinto gives. I think that Rio Tinto is going to lob a takeover offer, which means they're going to limit my upside.
Yeah.
I think that Sovereign, left to its own devices, could, over 5 years, be a 10-bagger. This is a tier one deposit, which to me means over $10 billion in in-situ recoverable reserves and resources, return on capital employed in excess of 25%, leverageable, and likely to be in the lowest cost quartile worldwide in its topics.
Yes.
Unanswered question, ironically, the size of the deposit, it almost certainly gets bigger, but process and product quality in the graphite are the unanswered questions. I love Sovereign. Note for your viewers, a lot of conflicts here. I own a boatload of Sovereign.
I own Sovereign. I think all of us here own Sovereign. Is it a question for you? I mean, I guess that Rio might throw out $2 billion US. Do you think that's a reasonable valuation?
I have no idea.
You can't say it. You don't know.
The good news about having Rio at 19% is that you have Rio at 19%.
Yes.
The bad news is a competitive fight. They're in a 100-meter dash, and they started on the 20-meter line.
Yeah,
that is going to be an impediment to the Glencores and the BHPs of the world who might compete with them. It's really difficult to have an auction with one bidder.
But
that's the difficulty they have. Means is that I'm almost certain to make some money as opposed to as much money as I'd like to make. Mm. That's not a bad outcome, where my downside is an upside.
Rick, when you say it's a four, what does that mean? Okay, you go in from 1 to 10. What
1 to 10.
Four?
I'm an extremely harsh ranker.
And four, one is the best?
One is the best. One, by the way, means that I think it's selling for half of immediate liquidation value. where I think that within 2 years, liquidation will double, and where I think that in five years, I'll have a 10-bagger. My last one was ExxonMobil when it got thrown out of the Dow 30. My last one before that was Ivanhoe Mines when it was selling at 63 cents a share with 93 cents a share cash in it and the Kamoa Kakula discovery. So my rankings are very, very, very hard. Very harsh.
So what about Conroy then? Or go to the next ranking then.
Yeah, let's go to Conroy. It's unranked. I don't know enough about Conroy to discuss it intelligently. My knocks against it were I didn't know the management team at all. Ireland does not have a history of being economically generous with large deposits. It has yielded up a fair number, particularly in the zinc business, of small hydrogen.
Galmoy was the same management that did Galmoy. It's Conroy Gold.
Yeah, I got it, which, to me was a moderate success. It wasn't a world-scale success. When I looked at the resource base, I could see 500,000 ounces there. I could see the chance that it might double. But for me to be interested, I have to see the probability of 1 million ounces or better. I'm not trying to say that stocks can't work otherwise, but from my viewpoint, I need large targets. So I don't have the company rated. I understand.
It's out. 2 million is your sort of cutoff, isn't it, from what I remember?
You mean market cap?
No, the ounces.
No, a million. But I really have to see some data that suggests to me. I mean, I have to see where it's going to come from. I don't always get there, by the way. you have hole A and hole B, and you put a hole C in between A and B, and you get dusted. But I have to see spatially how it could occur. But Power Metals, I own. Power Metals is a process stock. Mm-hmm. I own it because I used to make a lot of money myself building shells, a lot of money. And in the process of shell building, I think the worst I ever did was a 40% internal rate of return.
Well, that's not too shabby.
I'm too old to do that anymore. I can't allocate $250,000 against 19 months of my life. I can't do that anymore. The guys at Power Metals do that. And the idea that I could participate vicariously, in other words, I could put up some money and they could do all the work. They would show me the opportunities that they generated and I could follow on, participate if I wanted to, but mostly because they can build a machine in shell building similar to the machine that I built in the 80s and 90s, and I can participate passively. That's something I want to do. They also could be an eye on AIM. Mm. I'm inefficient in the London market because AIM is a shitty market, and I don't go there. But the fact is that there's a lot of good mining entrepreneurs in London. There's a lot of money in London. It wasn't a shell market that I ever tried to compete in. I competed both in Perth and in Vancouver. Well, but I'd rather somebody younger and stronger than I do that business for me, and that's why I own Power.
No, so you don't have a ranking for Power?
I do, 5.
Okay, very good.
And I own it. Relative to the trading liquidity, I own it in size. I may be the largest shareholder. I don't know.
Yeah. Right, Phil, do you want to start with your second one then?
Yeah, so my second one, and you might like this one, Ricky, is the fact that Rio Tinto are involved in a joint venture sense. So it's Aterian PLC. They're listed in London under the ticker ATN with a market cap of 7 million. A critical metal-focused company engaged in an exciting phase of exploration and development. Aterian's collaboration with Rio on their Rwanda lithium project showcases a potential to impact the global battery metal supply. They recently completed extensive soil sampling in Rwanda, identifying key areas for lithium-bearing minerals and are poised to start drilling next month. In Morocco as well, Aterian oversees a substantial portfolio across 900 square kilometres, exploring for a copper, a venture that could yield even greater results. They're not just about exploration. Aterian also has set up a metal trading entity in Rwanda, aiming to generate early revenue to fund further project developments. This dual strategy of immediate revenue generation paired with significant exploration potential could position Aterian uniquely in the market, offering a compelling diversified investment opportunity in critical battery metals and copper essential for global energy transition.
I do not own Aterian. I know it. I have it as a 5. I interviewed them for the Mining Journal Select conference, which is how I came to know them. The Morocco assets are not advanced enough for me to understand particularly. although I'm going to Morocco, and I'll come back with a much better sense of what they're attempting to do in Morocco. I know the people who generated those assets, and I've known them for 25 years. Those assets were spun in to create Aterian. I'm intrigued by what they're doing in Rwanda, but again, there isn't enough data. I'm particularly intrigued, though, that because of the company's background, the executive background, they were able to tempt Rio in very early on. In fact, it's a fairly soft joint venture with lots of exits for Rio. I also believe that for the next 2 years, at least, the bloom is off the lithium rose. So the idea that I would get some sort of back breeze as a consequence of the fact that the moron stormed into lithium is a low probability. But despite the fact that I don't own it, the market capitalization relative to the expertise of the people involved intrigues me. The metals trading operation, I've known a lot of people who started metals trading operations, particularly informal, and I assign that a negative net present value. I think it's a distraction and likely will fail.
You should go to Rwanda and see the gorillas anyway. Never mind. It's amazing.
I've done that.
Yeah. We were there last year. We visited Aterian and a few of the different places, and then we went to see the gorillas.
I've done that in Rwanda and Uganda, and I recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, life-changing experience for sure. When you see the silverbacks come out, it's phenomenal.
I'm going to go with Galileo Resources, which is an explorer predominantly in Zambia. Any of the Zambian explorers, whether it's Arc Minerals or Extract, Galileo, Bezan, there's a few of them. That's just on AIM, and obviously there's more. Anyone exploring in Zambia, going after copper, I think as long as they've got decent tenure, it's worth an investment at the moment. Galileo has a variety of assets, as Luan Sobe and Shinganda, and then a Northwest Zambian joint venture with a Cooper Lemon consultancy. All of these have resources of some kind, but they're all being drilled at the moment. And this is the thing for me, it's money going into the ground during the drilling season. Shinganda, we've got a 2,400 meters of reverse circulation drilling. The Northwest Zambia joint venture, there's going to be just 700 meters, so just kind of a starting phase two. And then there's exploration going on at Luan Sobe as well. All of these assets have copper there. Luan Sobe in particular is very interesting to me because the mining license was issued a couple of months ago. But then on top of that, it's just 15 kilometers from the Nolfalira mine, which, as we all know, produced 9 million tons of copper. Now, if you speak to any kind of a geologist who has kind of experience in Zambia, particularly in the northwest, they'll all tell you there's tens of millions of tons of copper to be discovered. And this is a metal that everybody wants, which I find quite interesting. I mean, copper at the moment is kind of like, the word I don't want to use is sexy, but it is. It's a sexy mineral that everybody wants. But you
Greenland
can understand why.
It as a new oil, didn't he? I mean, it's the...
It's what people want. And you can understand why when you look at the supply gap. And yet, interestingly, like lithium is kind of collapsing, as you just said, Rick. But, I look at lithium stocks at the moment, I think they're very good value, and nickel as well, based on what's happening in Indonesia. But I can't help but look at Galileo and other stocks like it in Zambia and think Zambian copper is where you want to be over the next few years.
I had the very good fortune of underwriting First Quantum at 65 cents.
Wow.
On its way to $100. So I have a particular fondness for Zambia. It made me look smart against all odds. And I agree with you in terms of the exploration upside. I'm concerned about small copper explorers who are exploring too much with their own money. Mm. I think the role of a junior in Zambia is to address the political realities of Zambia. I said that politely, didn't I?
Yes.
Acquire the concessions, and then having de-risked them from a social and political point of view, bringing in a joint venture partner.
Mm.
I don't follow the company for just that reason. I'm attracted to copper exploration. It's been extraordinarily good to me in my life. But my exploration model is very much that the juniors should use their expertise in other people's capital. And as a consequence, well, as I remember this story, there are two joint ventures in their portfolio. Perhaps there's one joint venture in their portfolio. I'm concerned about their ability to pursue expensive frontier soil risk exploration on their own balance sheet, so I don't follow it.
I think that
African
may change.
African Pioneer is probably the one in that stable then that has a joint venture with First Quantum.
Right.
Mm.
In Zambia, in that northwest region.
And my favorite business model there is sort of a plethora of lottery tickets, which is to say a prospect generator that generates and turns four or five projects a year, so that at any point in time, they have fractional interests or royalty interests in 15 or 20 exploration programs. I've been a continuing funder of the prospect generators. Most people say, well, you don't end up with 100% of the property. The fact is that the anticipation of success is that one in 3,000 mineralized anomalies becomes a mine. The idea that I would dilute myself for a one in 3,000 chance of success so that I could have 100%, I would rather not dilute at the intellectual property level, and I would much rather dilute at the property level, which I realize makes me dumb.
I'm absolutely with you, Rick, but the reality is a lot of us are investing in this for that dream ticket.
And that isn't necessarily a wise investment.
Go
your best lick. You know, go your best lick.
It's the dream ticket, isn't it?
It's the dream. It's
living the 10-bagger dream.
But then, but then, you know, it's funny because sometimes you'll see a joint venture signed or an earn-in or, you know, whatever. And the terms don't look that good and everybody's complaining. And you're sitting there thinking, well, do you know what? 30% of a potential discovery is better than 100%. Of a patch of dirt that you can't afford to explore by yourself.
Correct.
People don't want to hear
arithmetic.
It.
Simple arithmetic. And most speculators hate arithmetic. They prefer narrative.
Yes.
Just like most speculators, would prefer to pull the handle on a slot machine. And I would prefer to own the slot machine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've had this conversation. You know, I had this conversation with another analyst a few days ago. I was saying, you know, you can go to a table in blackjack and put $10,000 down, right? And you've effectively got a 50-50 chance of doubling your money. So if you just want to gamble, then gamble. But if you're speculating, then it's a different kind of game.
Well, or you try and own a piece of the table.
Yeah. Well, that's an it. Well, that's what you try to do, isn't it? Yeah. You want a piece of every table.
The house always wins, as you say.
Yeah.
Okay. So the last one we've got is called Jubilee Metals, another one that has come from Africa, this part of the world. It's now in the top three chrome producers in the world, with the PGM byproduct all based in South Africa. Next year's chrome target, 1.65 million tons estimated for 2025 for the chrome with added on. But PGM is profitable still, but with the PGMs under scrutiny in terms of price at the minute, it's not doing so well. But the exciting part of this one and why I chose it is the progress expected on the copper in Zambia. They have two processing facilities, one at Rowan and one at Kabwe, which now have the capacity to generate 25,000 tons of copper in both cathode and concentrate form. We visited these places last year, generating huge revenues of circa $225 million, with probably circa $100 million plus of profit in dollars. There's a market cap of circa £170 million sterling, or $220 million US dollars. It looks to use its systems to progress by adding on more and more processing facilities as it go on. And the final kicker is it signed a deal for a waste rock project with IRH, who basically out of Abu Dhabi, who basically spent $1.5 billion with the Zambian government to buy the Mofalira complex. And that's where buy 51% of that mine. And yet that's just down the road from where Lewin Sobey was in Galileo, as we said. So what's your thoughts on Jubilee Metals?
I'm not unattracted to Jubilee. It's cheap. Their returns on capital employed and their margins are very variable. And I think that you are exposed to political and social risk in South Africa, including, of course, the politics of envy. I don't own Jubilee, but I have it as a four on a valuation basis. The retreatment in Zambia, I assign no net present value to. I found that most often in those circumstances, the major that controls the rock has squeezed out as much value from the rock as can be squeezed on reasonable margins. So as I say, I have it as a four on a valuation basis, but I don't own it. And I need to say, gentlemen, I have to step off. I have to be on another call a minute ago.
Yeah. Okay.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, really on that note, we'll say it's been a fantastic time with you, Rick, and we really value your insights into everything we've talked about. It's been a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to a rematch.
Rick, can we ask you one question just before you go? And it's a very, very quick question. because you're on the Sunday roast, we have to ask you, what is your favorite roast dinner?
Oh, God. You know, my list of top 10 favorite foods has 54 items on it. I like everything. I guess if you had to pitch me down to one thing, it's not really a roast. My favorite food is probably abalone, but it's so stupidly priced I can't bring myself to buy it anymore, despite the fact that I could afford it. If I was coming to London, I guess that would probably have to be the classic old either a lamb roast or a beef roast, both of which I dearly love. If you could see me, you could see that I love them too much.
Excellent. On that note, we'll say Rick Rule, renowned investor, financial commentator. Thanks very much for your time.
Cheers, Rick. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So, yeah, that was a really lovely chat with Rick. I mean, the first thing I would say is he's a funny guy, right? He cracked me up. And the way he speaks, it's as though he's singing from my same hymn sheet, but in words which are just far better than me because he said them 1,000 times. I think that, you know, the way he views the market, the way he views the world, he just thinks in a different kind of perspective to us, which is quite refreshing, just because he has so much more capital. So when we're talking about investing, you know, like 50 grand or 100 grand into like a company with like a 5-10 million pound market cap, the equivalent for him is to invest sort of a few million into something with a 50 or 100 million pound market cap. And therefore, these sort of like very small opportunities that could get very big, he's not paying attention to them. He's looking at like the sovereign metals of the world, you know, potentially where you could see a huge return. But yeah, I found him very entertaining. But, you know, the thing is with Rick, he's not just in junior resource. He's also in forestry. He's also in farming. He's also in oil and gas. His battle bank is his newest thing. So there's lots of different opportunities. I wonder if he'll ever go into AI, which will be, you know, the next big, well, we say it's the next big thing. AI seems to be, regardless of what anyone else thinks, it seems to be progressing faster and faster. I think it will be like the year 2000. It's a bubble that will pop, but there will still be massive winners thereafter. There's two companies I want to quickly touch on AI. So NVIDIA, obviously, in America. NVIDIA's problem is that the expectations are now so high that no matter how well they do, it'll never be enough.
Well, explain that one, because I saw that their revenue had effectively more than doubled in the past quarter, and they ran off well. You know, the growth has been, you can't argue with that, but the shares fell. Why did they fall so much?
Well, okay, so they jumped 122% to just over $30 billion in the latest quarterly results. An analyst has only anticipated $28.7 billion in revenue. The problem you have is that whatever they put their target as, and whatever the analysts say, the investors are thinking they'll beat it 1,000 times over because there's so much hype in this AI train. Eventually, you know, the hype will fade. NVIDIA will still be one of the most valuable companies in the world. But the reality is that if the analysts are saying you're going to make X amount of money and then NVIDIA makes X plus one amount of money, but everyone's expecting X plus two, you're going to get a bit of a sell-off. But, you know, it's not just NVIDIA, these kind of giant companies at the top. You know, the very small cap, like one, something that came across my desk the other day, Priority AI, which is going to RTO on the market in the UK. Maybe not something for US investors at the moment, but these kind of very small cap plays at the very bottom could also make a fortune, because just like, you know, the Amazons of the world, the Apples, the Googles, all of them started out, you know, in garages, you know, with nothing. This new AI wave is going to generate a whole new bunch of players. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, we're talking on the OTC market, and in terms of OTC stocks, that you know, it's overwhelmingly dominated by mining. The three I think we should have a quick chat about: there's Power Metal Resources, there's Guardian Metal, and then there's Sovereign Metals. So obviously, you know, Rick has just been talking about these three. But Power Metal, this is a company which I think is severely undervalued. They own almost 50% of Guardian Metal shares. They have up to 15, 16 million pound joint venture with ACAM, about to be signed off for the Athabasca uranium assets. And they're about to launch some kind of deal in Saudi Arabia, which could be worth another sort of 10, 20 million-ish. And they have a market cap of, you know, maybe a third of where they should be just based on the net asset value. There's going to be a string of news coming in through Q4, and it's going to do. I think the share price is going to recover very nicely. The next one I think we should have a quick chat about is Guardian Metal. There's three things to be aware of here. So Guardian owns the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States, so it's already a strategic asset in many ways. The first thing is that China has just banned the export of antimony from the country, or at least severely controlled it. Alumony is antimony, not alumony. What am I talking about? That's why.
Isn't alumony something a bit like monogamy? Is it like a marriage thing?
Yeah, no, well, sort of, because antimony and tungsten are sisters, right, effectively, on the periodic table. I mean, if they're going to ban one, they'll probably ban another. So we're expecting a tungsten export ban soon, which will be very good for Guardian. But then on top of that, there's going to be grant funding, which they applied for over a year ago now. It's probably going to land in Q4 for the company. And then you've got Assays coming back from ongoing drilling as well. When you get to those kind of grant funding and China's actions, this strategic project will become a critical strategic project, and I suspect you're going to get a lot of fund action in there. And then the third one we need to have a quick chat about Sovereign Metals. This is the largest rutile deposit and the second largest graphite deposit in the world. Hydraulic mining has just started at the pilot plant, and most recently Rio Tinto has once again upped its stake to just shy of 20% of the company's shares. Because this stock is it's on the OTC, it's AIM listed, but it's also ASX listed. If Rio Tinto goes above 20%, it has to make a buyout offer for Sovereign Metals as a company. I've joked to them what they should do is just initiate a quick buyback without Rio looking, so it jumps above 20%. But apparently that would be in bad taste, so they're not going to do that. But the basic point you need to understand is that this company is just severely undervalued. A buyout offer will come, hopefully within the next few months, but definitely within the next couple of years. And when it does, it'll be a huge premium to what we have now. And yeah, I mean, that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, so Charles, if people are interested in those three companies that you just alluded to, what are the tickers on them?
On the OTC, it's POWMF for Power Metal, SBMLF for Sovereign Metal, and GMTLF for Guardian Metal.
Very good. Okay, I mean, on that note, is there anything else? Well, just talk us through, I mean, the Fed and the interest rate decisions in the US, because obviously we haven't spoken for a good month, but what do you make of the way the market's going? Also, the dollar, the value of the dollar against other currencies. Just talk us through the wider market in the US.
Well, I think in terms of, you know, what the Fed are doing, they just had to reshuffle, essentially, a lot of the figures that they've had for the past year, and which effectively makes the US economy look a lot worse than what they previously thought it was. So, you know, the Fed's mistake with inflation was pretending it was transitory, even though it wasn't, and even though they pumped billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars into the economy. And then, obviously, inflation spikes, so now they had to increase the interest rates, and they did it too late. And now they're possibly going to reduce the interest rates too late. That's the risk that they're running. The danger is that, okay, well, they're hoping for a soft landing, but every time that you've reduced interest rates going into a recession, which is potentially what the US is about to do, it's ended in some kind of short-term calamity. And I say short-term because 2008 is, you know, the poster child, at least for our generation, of like the worst thing that could happen. That recession only lasted for 5 quarters, and then it was growth again, you know? So, but I do think that they have been too slow now. And the real danger they have is that whatever they do now is political, because what they would like to do is nothing, because there's an election coming up in November. And if they cut rates, it looks like they're trying to support the Democrats. But if they do nothing, they'll tank the economy, which looks like they're trying to support the Republicans. So there's nothing they can do politically. So they have to take an action, and doing nothing is an action for the first time in a long time.
Do you not think that the market is pricing in a Harris win in the sense that it's still buoyant and strong, whereas Trump had come in and with his, or, you know, some of his bills that he wants to put in place, it's going to mean more spending, it's going to mean more debt, effectively?
Well, the thing is, you know, the US Constitution, I can't think of the words, in the United Kingdom, a prime minister with a majority in the House of Commons has supreme legislative and executive power. The Supreme Court can pretty much do nothing against him. So they can do whatever they want, pretty much. Keir Starmer, with his majority, can do whatever he wants, which is quite frightening. When the Americans, you know, one of the big reasons why they created the Constitution as it is, because they looked at the UK model and went, no, we're going to separate the powers. We're going to have the executive, in terms of the president, the legislative, which is going to be the Houses of Congress, so that's the Senate and the House of Representatives, and then we're going to have the judicial, which is the Supreme Court. So if Trump gets in power, the only way he can affect real change, and like serious change that he wants to do on the scale that he wants, he needs to have the Supreme Court, which he does have because he packed it back when he was in charge, but he also needs a majority in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and it's unlikely that he'll get both. That's just the reality. And so he will be able to, and this is actually one of the key things to understand about American politics. He'll be able to get some reforms through, but not everything that he wants. Versus in the UK. But then you see in the UK the kind of nightmare scenario that we're having come through, you know, where just lunatic laws get passed all the time because you've got one person with all the power. In America, it's the opposite. You can't get anything done. But it does mean you have a more stable investing environment. So it should be fine, no matter who's in charge. Okay.
Yep. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Let's see how it all works out. I think, I think the dollar has declined off its highs from 104, 105. down to the sort of 100 mark. If it breaks the 100, then I think we could see a decline. And they need a decline anyway to basically get rid of the real valuation of what they owe.
Well, the deficit, crazy. We spoke to Rick about that. I can't remember whether we recorded that bit, but the deficit in the US is just a looming cliff edge of epic proportions.
The interest on the deficit alone is crazy.
Well, is it more than defense spending now in America? Is, you know, I think they've got the four largest armies in the world, and yeah, no chance.
Well, on that note, yeah, I mean, so just want to say thanks to Rick Rule. Thanks for everybody listening. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and hit the bell icon for any further notifications of future episodes. And say have a great weekend. And yeah, once again, thanks for listening.